Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode.
Oh, well, thank you. What have you been up to this week?
I have been celebrating my birthday.
Yeah, that is true, actually. Yeah, we've been out and about with you bowling and failing to bowl. Oh, I did terribly at that.
Do you? I think me and Atta came joint last.
I mean, I got like I got over 100.
Yeah, you beat me.
In my mind, that's I don't feel as bad, but it's been a very long time since I've been bowling, and at least I didn't finish under 100. I feel a bit better in that sense.
Yeah,
but in most of the game was very bad.
when you go, obviously everyone knows what bowling's like, I suppose. But like when you go and it's on your last turn on turn 10. There's three boxes, and that's because if you get a strike in any of your first two boxes, it gives you a bonus go. Gareth got a strike first time, and then the second he managed to get a half strike. Yeah, spare. So he was.
But it didn't show up on the thing.
It did at the end.
Our screen didn't work anywhere near as good as it should have. To which I still thought it was my go. And ended up getting a strike for your brother who was next. Yeah. So, I mean, he was happy. He wasn't upset, but yeah, I felt bad for like stealing his go. But yeah. So technically, I actually got a second strike, just not when it was my turn. But yeah. Well, you haven't been up to much else animal related, I assume, then this week?
Not animal related, no. No, I've had a really nice time with my partner and our daughter, and a really nice time seeing you guys.
I don't think I've done a giant amount animal wise. I had to prop one of my trees up with the weather we've had of late. Has made
the
ground in my garden so boggy, it started to lean so much that it was getting closer.
You're not going to have to prop your house up, are you?
Not the house, no. But my poor tree seems to be leaning to one side, so I've sorted that out. That was interesting. But
are you on a floodplain?
No, we're in a flooded forest. We're on the edge of a flooded forest, which has become very apparent over the years of living here, as to it being like the Amazon, in that there is a layer of clay. And that stops all of the water from soaking down into the ground. I'm guessing we are on an ancient floodplain, but it's long since been a floodplain.
I'm just wondering. I was just asking because you're at the basin of a valley.
We're at the top of the valley. Yeah.
You're at the bottom, I think, aren't you?
I mean, yes, I suppose we are. Yeah. But maybe an ancient river was once there, but we're talking thousands of years ago, to the point where it is now just clay under the soil. But it's an actual habitat type is a flooded forest in the UK. If you go out into the forest behind us, just you're constantly walking through puddles in amongst willow and ash and oak and everything, but it's just what's there. All of the housing that's built around here is built on the edge of that, so you dig down more than a foot before you even get close to actual soil, and even then it's not very porous. It's clay. It's the whole thing is just clay. Be really nice, like, you know, you could have a clay pit out the back there to mine clay, but yeah, not much else. So yeah, it's we're slowly converting a lot of the soil that's in the garden with, you know, planting of things and veg and mulch and all of that, so
yeah,
making it a bit more fertile, although it doesn't seem to stop some of the trees that are out there, but they're a bit more resilient getting through it. Yeah, well, shall we move on from talking about my back garden, how it's a bog,
yes,
to The news for this week.
Let's do it.
It's the news.
Right, well, we're into this week's news. Aaron, take us out.
Every week, we are inundated with news coming out of the weird and wonderful world of natural sciences. And though we are but a small team, we want you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, to be kept up to date on the good, the bad, and the extraordinary. So let's open up our natural history cupboard newsreel and dive on in, see what we've got.
So I've got, first up, from the Otago Daily Times, perfect spot. Sea lions invade tent for a siesta. You can always rely on New Zealand to come up with some fun ones, especially with marine life, because they have constantly stories of, you know, elephant seals turning up and just lying on people's cars and stuff like that. Well, this is two sea lions lie down to rest underneath a tent at the Junior Carnival at St. Clair on Sunday. Two sleeping sea lions used the clothes and pillows of beachgoers to basically have a nap on. But attendees at the regional surf life saving event found that this is just the case that they just had to deal with when they went to fetch their bags and found two sea lions asleep. One of them looked like it was using the clothes as a pillow, someone said. The carnival is a monthly event that brings together the surf life saving clubs around Otago and St. Clair and was taking its turn to host. And from the photo that comes with it, I mean, it's not a vacant beach by any stretch of the imagination. It is quite, there's quite a few tents set up. There's loads of stuff all over the beach, and this is a good distance from the water. And these two sea lions have just decided, yeah, we're just going to just pitch up here and have a snooze. And yeah, basically that's it. They had a bit of a snooze and then went back to the sea.
Why not? My first article this week comes to us from Science Daily. And the headline is, student discovers 200-million-year-old flying reptile. A discovery made by master's student Mike Cawthorn whilst researching reptilian fossils from the Mendip limestone quarries of Somerset has offered a new window into the West Country's prehistoric past. His finds, published in Proceedings of the Geologists Association, records the presence of reptiles with complex teeth, including a trilophosaur, a viridans, and the behaviorally otter-like Pachystrophius, and two species of cuneosaurs, who, despite being closely related to crocodilian ancestors, were small and able to glide via the use of skin stretched across elongated side ribs.
Very cool. I'm West Country dinosaurs and reptiles. I'm just picturing them, you know, arguing over jam and scones and pasties and things. From the BBC, I've got Longleat Safari to build dangerous animal enclosure. Not that they don't already have.
I was going to say
dangerous animals. It being a zoo.
Tigers.
So this is a wonderful example of the BBC or someone whoever wrote this story jumping on the fact that planning permission has been given for Longleat to build a brand new African painted dog enclosure.
Ooh.
Which I thought you'd find very interesting. But yes. Obviously, because when applications for these things go through to local councils, it obviously has to state they are a dangerous animal. So that's where they've gone with that. Not anything about the fact that these are a highly endangered animal. It's just that they are, as it says, it will house African wild dogs, also known as painted dogs, an endangered species native to sub-Saharan Africa. That's about as much as you get on the actual animals, but it's apparently to help boost visitor numbers, which have flagged since COVID a bit. However, I've got to admit, every time I've been to Longleat within the last couple of years, it's been pretty busy. It's not exactly been quiet, but they are getting
rid. Very busy.
They are getting rid of one area, which did used to house domestic animals, to build the new African painted dog enclosure, as well as making an adjustment to the pre-existing area known as the African Village, which also exhibits giraffe, zebra, and ostrich, none of which are considered dangerous.
Yeah, I can picture where they're going then.
And then the final bit it goes on with is the enclosure will be surrounded by a secure fencing, 8 foot high, with a 50-centimeter angled top section. So yeah, basically someone's read the planning permission notes for this.
it's not going to be, yeah, they've read the planning permission, but haven't taken the time to go and read up about the animal other than the fact it's endangered and it's a dog at the end of the day. That sounds like it's going where the goats and potentially where the tortoises were. Does that mean that that would make it a walk past or walk around enclosure, not a drive through enclosure?
I think it's going to be, yeah, I think it's going to be something along those lines, but the way that it's worded.
See, I was full of excitement when you read the headline, but now I'm a bit like I'm a bit not nervous, but a bit unsure what that's gonna how that's gonna manifest, because that's on the side of a hill and it's quite a wooded hill as well. and these animals come from like the plains, so I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, sounding not too horrible, they may actually end up chopping the trees down in that area if it's an area that needs to be managed woodland as well. It may be case if they remove some of the trees, but
fair enough. Fair enough.
Well, we'll have to go and have a look.
Yeah. Yes. The moment that opens, that would be great. So coming to us from Life Science, watch chameleon erupt in color as if uttering her last words in her final moments before death. That sounds really sad, but it's actually really interesting. The incredibly short-lived Labords chameleon. Have you ever heard of those, Gareth?
The name sounds familiar, but I'm not 100% on a lot. Are they the ones that only live like 4 months?
That's right. They're the shortest-lived.
Yeah.
Shortest-lived
reptile, definitely.
Yeah, potentially vertebrate. I'd have to look up. Maybe a good potential creature feature in the future. But the incredibly short-lived Labords chameleon spends more time in an egg than out of it, living just 5 months after hatching. For a new educational series, PBS filmmakers followed the female from hatching to laying her own eggs as she prepared for the dry season, dying just hours later. The footage is a special accomplishment as their full cycle had never been documented. So yeah, it sounds sad, but actually her entire life from natural hatching to naturally passing away was all captured. So now we have video evidence of that life cycle and can learn from it.
Hmm. Well, I'll continue with the sad theme and also continue with the longleat theme, actually, because sadly, Longleat Safari Park's fan favorite hippo, Spot, has died. This is the sad news.
Oh, no.
One of its beloved hippos will be deeply missed after dying at the age of 49, which is a decent age. Spot lived at Longleat since 1977, and the fellow hippo Sonia also died at 49 in April of 2023. Like all the animals at Longleat, she was very special and loved by her keepers, and is obviously quite missed. And for those of you who've been to Longleat, you can go on a boat tour in the big lake that's there. And they had one of the oddest combinations of any animals around. Sea lions, Californian sea lions, with Nile hippo.
And gorilla.
Oh, gorilla on the island, as well. So sadly, that means that is the last hippo gone from Longleat Safari Park. So be sadly missed. Yeah, hopefully they'll bring in some more in the future.
And my last article comes to us from fizz.org. Hell chicken species suggest dinosaurs weren't sliding toward extinction before fatal asteroid hit. One commonly held belief carried over from the forever guilty Victorians is that dinosaurs were sluggish and stupid and on their way out. It's a belief that Gareth and I would agree is a natural history cupboard pet peeve. Yet there is hope, as even more evidence comes out to debunk this silly notion. A paper published in PLOS One documents the discovery that was once thought of as a juvenile specimen is actually a full-grown adult of an entirely new species, demonstrating that dinosaur diversity was not at all at an all-time low before the asteroid impact occurred, and supporting the idea that more dinosaurs are yet to be discovered, possibly even through reclassification of ones already held in museums.
Mm. So I'm going to round up my ones for this week with yet another one. It seems to be mine have all been very zoo-based this week, and it's because the BBC seemed to have come out with a couple of very good zoo-based ones. But this is also from the BBC. What should you do if you encounter an escaped monkey?
Now, Aaron, this is in Scotland, isn't it?
Yes, this has only happened today as of recording. A Japanese macaque has escaped from the Highland Wildlife Park and is on the loose in the Cairngorms. So for anyone who doesn't know where that is, that's the north of Scotland, so much further up than Edinburgh. And the Cairngorms is, like I say, home to the Highland Wildlife Park.
It's in Kingussie, I think.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's a really nice part of the world.
Really nice park, too.
Attempts are being made to recapture it, but what advice has been given to people living near the zoo? My advice would be don't get too close to it, because Japanese macaques are fairly hefty animals, but at the same time, I wouldn't be overly scared. It's not out to get you.
No.
So it managed to break out from its enclosure at the Highland Wildlife Park near Kincraig, south of Aviemore on Sunday. The 7-year-old male, which is about the size of a medium-sized dog, was part of a troop of 37 animals at their quite large enclosure. Heath Gilchrist from the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland said, "It's a very dynamic group of animals with quite strong hierarchies. And this time of the year is the breeding season, so tensions run a little bit high and sometimes fights break out over breeding rights. And essentially, the adrenaline can sometimes override them. And rather than get into a fight, it seems that this one has just gone for it, got past the enclosure perimeter and kept on going." So it's obviously a fairly low ranking male, I'm guessing, in the group. But yes, the sensible things have been said is obviously do not try and approach it. Do not try and touch it or anything like that, because they have fairly big teeth on them. Attempts at the moment are underway to obviously recapture the macaque, because there's not going to be much for it to be able to eat in the Highlands. And of course, the article then has loads of pictures of the typical Japanese macaque in the hot springs, which it's clearly going to find up in the Cairngorms.
I was going to say, like,
might find someone's jacuzzi.
For those of you who are trying to work out what a Japanese macaque is, it's the one that you stereotypically see bathing in a pool with snow all around it. These guys, they do come from cold climate. They'll be fine in Scotland.
Interestingly enough, though, that's only one small social group of Japanese macaques that actually use natural hot springs, and it was a totally learnt behavior.
If I was a Japanese macaque, that's the group that I would be part of.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, why would you waste your time sitting outside in the cold when you've got lovely hot springs to go and sit in? But yes, that is my story for this week. So if you're in the Cairngorms and you see a Japanese macaque, don't go in approaching it. Probably let the local authorities know.
Yeah, take your photos from a very safe distance with that. But that about wraps it up for this week's News Reel installment. Remember, if you guys have any news articles or topics waiting at home that are of interest to you and you think we should cover, then send them on in. You can use any of the usual ways to contact us. You might even decide to send an escaped macaque our way with a message in a
no
bottle.
Thanks.
But no, please don't. But you might see your topic or article covered here or in our main topics, which is what Gareth's going to crack open now. Gareth, what have you got?
So this is also from the BBC. I've gone heavily as to what they've had. They've had a nice
BBC
selection this week. This is England's hedges would go around the earth 10 times. It's quite an interesting article. England's hedgerows would stretch almost 10 times around the earth if lined end to end. And that's according to a new map, the most comprehensive and up-to-date map that has ever been made of our rural landscapes. So ecologists hope the data will lead to better predictions for how much the loved lines of trees and shrubs provide food and shelter for our wildlife and also store large amounts of carbons. Carbons? Carbon.
Carbons. Carbon. Many carbons.
Carbon. So laser scanning from the air has revealed a total length of 390,000 kilometers worth of hedges. Now, the southwest boasts the most hedgerows. No surprise there.
No.
And it's actually Cornwall that actually has the most out of the southwest. Devon comes last, actually, which is interesting. I would have thought Devon would have been right up there of the southwest, but Somerset comes next, and then Devon afterwards. However, we still vastly outweigh places like Surrey, Hampshire, and Berkshire, which have the least, and that is excluding big urban areas. And London is pretty much exempt from this entire thing. It doesn't really have hedgerows. On the map that is produced with this, it's all done in shaded areas, and you've just got white being the least, and dark green being the most, London is pure white. There's very little hedgerows. But why is this important? If you think of what the UK is classically looks like, the best example would probably be something like the Shire in Lord of the Rings. The yeah. idea of, and this is what Tolkien actually wrote an awful lot about. He was he grew up at a point where outside of Birmingham, where he lived, the actual urban sprawl was starting to come closer and closer to his what he considered the Shire, where he lived. This actually drove him to write a lot of the themes of stuff like that. I'm taking that very off the point. But towards the end of the 1940s, right up to the 1990s, we saw a massive amount of our hedgerows being taken out to intensify agriculture. So we went from having lots of these little small areas of hedgerow next to another small area of hedgerow, next to another small area of hedgerow, essentially making this nice patchwork all across the countryside of really important little biospheres full of areas for birds, mammals, reptiles to be able to hide away from predators and to breed and essentially to break up the landscape from what was there. Some of our earliest ones are actually Iron Age hedges. So they've been there for thousands of years, built by the original people who'd have lived on those parts of the land, encompassing them to keep cattle or livestock in, and being able to use the hedges as a way of stopping the animals from getting out. Traditional sort of plants we tend to see are things like hawthorn. Well, we find a lot of bramble in them. Things like oak, ivy. There is a massive amount of diversity of plants in these hedgerows. And by taking them out, you lose a patch of that habitat. And that's essentially what happened at the during the 1940s up to the 1990s. Intensification of agriculture meant that these small, lots of little fields were all turned into one massive field. And the wildlife that would have been able to cross nice and easily over these small fields found it a lot harder to cross over these massive, almost deserts of monocultured plants. We see it today when you have planes that actually do these LIDAR scans, and you can actually see the old mounds that exist under the ground of where the hedgerows once connected between the two areas. So they are, or they have been, a really, really important part of the landscape. And this mapping has now shown the areas that are the most dense, the areas that are the least dense. Some of them are not obviously so surprising that the West Country has the most because it's a rural area. But it shows where these areas can actually be improved upon. And biodiversity action plans can actually be made up from this information as well. So it's been obviously a really big downturn as to what has been lost over the years. But now we can actually work to make these areas better. The data itself calculated that there are some 390,000 kilometers of hedgerows in England alone. So we're not taking into account Scotland or Wales. And they measure anywhere between the height of 1 meter and 6 meters in height, which is about average for most of the sort of hedgerows you see around here. And additionally, there are 67,000 kilometers of lower hedgerows and a further 185,000 kilometers of overgrown hedges over 6 meters tall. And the Southwest has the greatest share of 24% of England's hedges. Excluding London, the Northeast has the lowest share at just 4%. The other regions have anywhere between 11 to 13% each. And at the county level, Somerset, Derbyshire, and Cornwall have the highest densities of hedgerows, per kilometre of each county. Government, interestingly enough, has promised to create or restore 48,000 kilometres of hedgerows by 2037 and 72,000 kilometres of hedgerows by 2050 under the new Environmental Improvement Plan released a year ago. Hopefully, these hedgerows will only get better and we will have more diversity in our hedgerows. Because I don't know about you, Aaron. I haven't done it for a few years now, but I used to love going out and picking blackberries along the hedgerows out in the countryside and having a look in and around the hedgerows themselves.
Yeah, we still do it, but then we're surrounded by hedgerows.
You've got more hedgerows around where you are, yeah.
We have a couple rules, though. Nothing under knee height.
Anything a dog can get to, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And also they need to be washed thoroughly. Because obviously there's still vehicles going along around there and other things. But yeah, we blackberries we go after, also strawberries, wild strawberries, and some hedges. I'm trying to think of what else, but it's also just nice to see the wildflowers and the different insects and birds using them, which is why it's such a shame that someone locally broke down their hedge in the middle of bird nesting season, which no one was happy about at the time. But yeah.
They're amazingly important ecosystems that do definitely get overlooked a lot of the time because they're just seen as a slightly green version of a fence, but they are very much integral wildlife corridors and biodiversity hotspots in an already urbanized country.
Yeah.
Right. Well, shall we move from the hedgerows into our creature feature for this week?
Let's do it.
It's the creature feature.
Right. Well, we're into this week's creature feature. Aaron, what are we looking at?
Well, yeah, Gareth, I've got a question for you. What is, in your opinion, the worst smelling poo that you've ever come across working with animals?
Animals, or do I get to include humans? Because I think humans are up there with it.
No, because I think humans probably smell the worst, but yeah, but no, a non-human animal.
Otter. Domestic dog.
Okay.
Mostly because I think of what it had eaten, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to say otter is probably the worst smelling poo.
Yeah, otter scat is really quite something.
Oh, yeah.
There are
very pungent.
A number of contenders I can think of. Big cats are particularly bad, especially soiled bedding from a cheetah enclosure. Maned wolf, always.
I think that's
really
their urine more than anything, but yeah.
It is, but yeah, it's a pretty foul smelling excrement. But I'll flip the question around. What would you say is the best smelling poo in the animal kingdom?
Oh, well, that's easy. That goes hands down to koalas.
Koalas? Okay.
Yeah.
Can you describe it for us?
Well, hear me out on this, because koala poo is obviously you are what you eat, and koalas eat eucalyptus leaves. So their poo basically smells like eucalyptus.
Oh, fair enough.
I might have blown that out of the water as to what you were hoping I'd say.
No, I was genuinely interested in your opinion. It's all subjective.
I'm also quite partial to the smell of like a rhino house, because I think rhino poo doesn't smell anywhere near as bad. Same with horse poo. It's not terrible because it's just chopped grass, basically.
Yeah, it doesn't smell terrible. I wouldn't say I'm partial to it, though.
I mean, I don't go around looking for it, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Something of a rhino poo connoisseur, are you?
Yeah.
I have an opinion on this as well, but we will get to it in a minute because it involves our creature feature for this week. And this week, I'd like us to look into the Asian bear cat, the intelligent, intrepid, and indescribably cool animal known as the binturong. This animal gets its name from a few different sources. The word binturong itself is the common name in Borneo. This comes to us from the Malayo-Polynesian name Maturan. In central eastern Sumatra, it is called benturong or tenturong, which again are two very similar words to the actual word binturong, which we use as well. Others have lovingly referred to them as I say, bear cats or even bear weasels. Its scientific name, however, has had something of a history itself. In 1822, both Vivera binturong and Paradoxus albifrons were proposed by Thomas Stamford Raffles and Frederick Cuvier, respectively.
Names, those. Those are pretty,
yeah,
pretty hefty names at that particular period in history in that part of the world.
Very important names, yeah. These were based upon a specimen from Malacca and a drawing from Bhutan by Alfred Duvisel. 2 years later, Konrad Jacob Temminck proposed Arctictis as a generic name describing its genus, and that seemed to stick. Temminck then followed this up in 1835 by proposing Arctictis penicillata, based on Sumatran and Javan specimens, and this would largely remain in place all the way until 1910, at which point Arctictis whitei was proposed by Joel Asaph Allen, describing specimens from the Palawan Islands. A Bornean skull described in 1911 by Ernst Schwarz was named Arctictis pagellae. And another skull, this time in the southwest of Thailand, was described as Arctictis, Arctictis gairdneri, by Oldfield Thomas in 1916. That same year, a skin from Nias Island would be described by Marcus Ward Leon Jr. as Arctictis niasensis. Now, specimens from Banker Island, described by Henry Jacob Victor Sodi in 1936, were named Arctictis Arctictis binturon kirkovani, and finally in 1987 Arctictis binturon mengleensis was proposed for a Chinese specimen described by Wang and Li. Now, today Arctictis binturon describes the species as a whole, the generic name having its root in Greek words arct for bear and ictis for weasel, so that bear weasel nickname is kind of accurate there. Whilst the specific name, that being binturon, denotes their local common name. And the species is represented by 9 subspecies across 2 clades. The northern clade resides on the mainland range that straddles South and Southeast Asia, whilst the southern clade makes their home on the Sunda Islands. In fact, a complete list of countries that binturons can call home includes Bangladesh, Bhutan, Cambodia, China, India, Indonesia, Java, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, Nepal, the Philippines, Sumatra, Thailand, and Vietnam. So quite a huge expanse of Asia there. Now, here in these home countries, the bear cat is fundamentally restricted to areas of dense tree coverage, especially where tall trees are particularly prevalent. So we're talking wooded foothills, hill forests, evergreen forests, primary and secondary lowland forests, areas of grassland forest mix, that kind of thing. It is a near inconceivable semi-complete stretch of land that this range spreads across. And yet the species is so sparsely populated in this area that they are unfortunately listed as vulnerable. But before I go into why, some of you may not know what a binturon actually is. So let's take a look. The binturon is a stocky beast, not comparable in size to a big cat, wolf, or bear, but oddly still with the appearance of an animal that would mess you up if you gave it a side eye. They are heavy animals. I know this personally because a female adored me and used to clamber onto my shoulders for a pseudo nap as I struggled to clean her enclosure. So we're talking sizes pushing 137 to 142 centimeter lengths, and they can weigh anywhere from 11 to 32 kilograms. So they're
it's
not
a little like having a Jack Russell with a very long tail climb onto your back.
Yeah, well, my mum has a Jack Russell, and I would say that this female,
maybe even a corgi.
This female is a little bit, but yeah, maybe corgi kind of weight. Yeah, they have short, muscular legs that end in 5 toes, and each of these toes is armed with a sharp claw. And these legs are used to stride purposefully across the forest floor or along the thicker branches of trees, and the claws aid in grasping and climbing. They have an incredibly strong prehensile tail that tapers from its thick base to a thinner curled point at the end. And they've got a nice little pad right at the end of this tail, which aids in gripping, obviously. This tail is used, obviously, in balance, climbing, hanging, or cuddling one specific arm of a zookeeper that you're trying to nap on. Their face is very round with a short snout and a nose that is almost turned upward and pointed. Their eyes are huge, whilst their ears are small and rounded. And the entire body is covered in a thick black coat of bristly fur. But fur near the ears tends to go greyish white, whilst fur near the nose often gets a little brownish. They look a little bit like mutant weasels. And I don't mean that in a harsh way, but they do kind of look like, you know, super enlarged palm civets that have been given some sort of Halloween monster cocktail to make them appear creepy and dark. There's something a little bit zombie about them, I think.
Their eyes are odd.
Yeah, yeah, they are a bit odd looking. They also carry on them the attribute for which they are most famously, or perhaps notoriously, known, and that's their scent glands. Now, these are located near the genitalia on both sexes, just under the tail, and they secrete a musk that reeks of cinema-stale popcorn. And it's for that reason that I think that their poo smells absolutely incredible. It's not that I'm partial to it. It's just that it's far better than all the other animals I've ever worked with. It is quite a unique smell. And that's down to the chemical makeup of the scent that they secrete. Now, whilst there is evidence in the form of camera trap collected data to support daytime and nighttime activity, perhaps their behavioural habits are best described as arrhythmic, with mostly crepuscular preferences. Activity peaks tend to be seen around early morning and late afternoon, with drop-offs around midday and mostly sedentary behaviour observed through the afternoon. Movements around their range during the dry season can be relatively unnoteworthy, or they can travel up to 2,000 metres. But during the wet season, their movement range almost doubles. In fact, the territories that they hold may actually expand a little bit during the wet season. Now, with a heavy reliance on aptly forested habitats and the limbs adapted, as I mentioned before, it will come as very little surprise to learn that these guys are arboreal in nature. They're not explosive in their movements. You'll seldom see them sprint or jump big gaps, but they're not sloths either. They are graceful and deliberate in their movements. They can easily traverse vertically up and down trunks, stride along branches, and even move along the underside of said branches with absolutely no problem whatsoever. And when they do descend to the lower levels, or indeed the forest floor, to bridge the larger gaps between trees, they do so facing the challenge head first, as I said, going vertically downwards by gripping tight and employing that awesome prehensile tail of theirs. They even sleep up high, curled up into a ball with the tail wrapped around them and used as a blanket. Now, in terms of like their social lives, that their communication is very subtle. They use vocal cues that are completely unsubtle. They're quite shocking screech growls, as well as quieter, almost mumbling grunts and hisses. In fact, whilst the female I worked with was very fond of me, the male would make me jump almost every time I entered their house for the first month or so, springing from some shadow-veiled corner onto the mesh and yowling at me, teeth bared. But as I say, most of their communication is subtle, far more subtle than that. The tail also takes on a secondary function in communication, as much of it is done via this limb and, of course, via body language itself, which can be interesting to observe, with the grooming and shaking of fur being a communicative behavior. On the subject of communication, whilst they are solitary by nature, they must obviously meet in order to mate. Males and females mature at different rates, but generally both will reach maturity before their third birthday. Females have an estrous cycle of 18 to 187 days. Now, to attract or indeed find a mate, males and females will drag their tail along the branches and other such kind of objects in their environment to initiate the scent glands I mentioned, before basically signing those objects in their vicinity with their unique popcorn smell. Investigating these odor-stained objects can lead individuals to invaders that they'll chase out their territory, or to potential mates that they'll use these scent-marked areas to track them down. And if mating is a successful venture, the female will experience a gestation period lasting around 84 to 92 days. After this, a litter of up to 6 shruggles will be born. And shruggle is the correct term for a baby binturong. Did you know that, Gareth?
I was unaware that a baby one is called a shruggle.
Yeah.
It's very similar to what a baby echidna or platypus is with puggle, but puggle, no, I like that. That's quite good.
Very cute. Usually, however, there are only 2 twins. Each of these will weigh just 142 grams and will hide in their mother's fur. By 8 weeks, they are already the size of a domestic cat, are covered in a thick coat themselves, and are already eating solid foods too. This fertility will continue until they reach 15 years of age, and their life expectancy is 25 years, though this is a figure that is born of data collected from captive specimens and would likely not represent that of a wild binturong, which I suspect would be quite a bit shorter. But what's special about female binturongs in terms of reproduction is that, just like the giant panda that we've spoken about before, they can delay implantation. This allows them to time the birth of their litter with the next season of plenty, when resource abundance is most likely to occur. Thus, mating can take place any time of the year, because the females essentially control when they want to give birth. So let's say we follow one of these individuals born from a litter. What are we expecting them to eat? Where the opportunity presents themselves, binturongs are truly omnivorous creatures. They hunt, they scavenge, and they forage. But that's not always the case. They don't typically present a particularly strong predatory behavioral repertoire for the most part, though they will hunt smaller species such as rodents, birds, and terrestrial or airborne insects. They'll also eat fish when they can get it, but they don't tend to actively fish themselves and are certainly not likely to venture into water all too often if they can help it. And they also don't really tend to dig. So subterranean species such as like underground insects like worms and such aren't high on the menu either. They do, however, love their fruits, particularly figs and plantains, that are of significant importance to the bearcat's diet. But it's also important, particularly for the fig, that they eat these fruits, because binturong are a really great example of nature's gardeners. They are a seed dispersal unit, packaged in a fierce looking but mostly cute carnival package. The seeds of the strangler fig go through the digestive tract of the binturong undamaged, and they exit in the fertile excrement of the animal, replanting the forest as the binturong poos. So really one of those kind of, don't want it to become cliche that we say this, but it is on a micro scale, an eco engineer of sorts. As I say, it is going around eating these figs and essentially replanting the seeds and letting them grow up again into new healthy trees. But casting our minds back to the beginning, I did mention that these guys were vulnerable according to the IUCN Red List. So what's going on there? It's mostly habitat loss, to be honest. Logging has been chiefly responsible for the degradation of their habitats, whilst palm oil plantations effectively deforest vast swaths of the environment and replace these tall and ancient trees with young and comparatively smaller palm trees. Some of the secondary forests that this species inhabits, they actually inhabit because they were pushed there by the arrival of these plantations and their activities. In fact, all evidence suggests that binturong won't use the plantation trees whatsoever. So these patches of their territory are well and truly lost forever, causing huge fragmentation of the population. The habitat loss has hit the southern clade, so the ones in the Sunda Islands, particularly hard, which shouldn't really come as a surprise considering what we hear about it, that that area of the world almost yearly because of the palm oil trade. The wildlife trade is another notable threat, particularly in Laos, in the Philippines, and in Vietnam, where this animal is often caged, consumed, or has its parts harvested and sold off. Licensed hunting is also permitted in Indonesia, and there are still some areas across its range where it enjoys no protection at all. However, there is hope. Included on Appendix 3 of CITES and in Schedule 1 of the Indian Wildlife Protection Act 1972, this species has the highest protections it can be given across the board, really. It is also completely protected in Bangladesh, whilst enjoying a little bit of protection across Malaysia, Thailand, and Vietnam, even though the latter of those places is one of the areas where wildlife trade is a problem for it. China lists the animal as critically endangered, and global zoos hold annual binturong awareness days dedicated to spreading the virtues of protecting this fantastic species. Furthermore, there are healthy captive breeding populations housed in good functional zoos across the world, meaning that there is, in fact, a decent genetic reservoir to bolster this species keep the captive populations nice and healthy in case we ever need to restock for a while. There is one last thing I wanted to finish on, which I thought was interesting, partially because I've spent time with these people and I never saw it. But several websites said that the Orang Asli, who are a they're a indigenous people of Malaysia, several websites said that these people actually keep binturongs as pets, which is really interesting for several reasons. Firstly, I can't imagine that that they are great pets, but at the same time, they're incredibly trainable and in my experience, apart from the male, lovely animals. But I never saw it. I spent a little bit of time, not a great deal of time, obviously, but I did stay with the Orang Asli for a couple of weeks, and there was no sign of any binturong being kept as pets whilst I was there. So
I've got to admit, it'd be like having. I think the one thing you haven't mentioned, Aaron, and certainly if it were for a pet angle, the ones that I worked with, and I'm sure the ones you worked with as well, they were always shedding.
Yes.
So you could just imagine having the shaggiest cat or dog. If you were to have one in your house, everything would be covered in thick, quite coarse black fur. Really
yes,
long
this is true.
Black fur.
This is true. I'm not advising anyone keep them as pets because really, really don't think they make good pets. But in the long list of animals that shouldn't be kept as pets, I imagine these are actually pretty tame compared to other things that are kept.
I've never known one to be overly vicious.
No,
but you
only,
would not want to be bitten by one.
No, the male was he was pretty hardcore. the female was perfectly fine. Like I said, she clamber up me and nap on my shoulders whilst I'm trying to clean the enclosure. But the male was just like, he was intense. yeah, he was really intense. But I just can't imagine ever, like, I can't even imagine wanting to keep one as a pet, but I can't imagine the chore of keeping one as a pet either. But yeah, I just wanted to point out that I never saw it. I would have been there are some things I hear about and I just think I'm not interested in that at all, but that's actually one thing where I would have liked to have had a conversation about it with someone. But yeah. So yeah, that's your binturong creature feature for this episode. A wonderful animal, and I'm not lying by saying that they are intelligent and intrepid animals. They really are extremely cool. If you go to a zoo to watch them, I don't know how to.
It depends on the place. It depends on the zoo as well, because some zoos
Longley,
they will be asleep a good chunk of the day, and you won't see much from them. They're a bit like red pandas in that sense, but if you see them moving around, really amazing. And then some have them in animal shows.
When I went to Longleat, I don't remember them having an animal show, but what I do remember is their enclosure was shared with Asian short-clawed otters. So there was a hive of activity going on because the short-clawed otters were very active. Also, there was this lovely, well-kept stream that ran through, that kind of babbling brook that ran through to a pond, so the water was moving as well, and there was a lot of climbing and ropes, like those kind of physical exercise activities going on, and there was lots of enrichment and toys going on as well. But the place, the other place where I've seen them, they're in a very small enclosure, and they've got a tree and a few beams to climb up around it. It's not, I don't mean it in a rude way, but in an honest way, it's not very interesting for a binturong. So it's no surprise that they don't really do much and you don't really see them.
Yeah, I know what you mean. They can sometimes be overplanted as well.
They're just not engaged.
And you never see them. Yeah,
they're just not engaged. That's the problem.
But yeah, they are an amazing species, which I can gladly join you in saying that I've worked with, and they are amazing, and they really do have a popcorn smelling smell to them.
Yeah.
Also, banana bread is the other the thing that people say that they smell of. I don't know.
My clothes
I don't...
just come home humming of it.
they are pongy things, but lovely pongy things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's move on to our emails for this week, shall we?
Let's do it.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email.
Right. Well, we're into this week's emails. We'll start things off with our listener question from last week. And this was, it's actually turned into quite a fun one, this one. What is your favorite alternative name for an animal, i.e. a snake being a danger noodle? We got some really good comments on this one. So I've got, hang on, 4 from Zara Jackson, who has put disco chicken, meaning peacock. Actually, 5 from her. Sorry, she replied to one of her own ones. Or rave turkey is the other name for a peacock. I quite like that.
I think the rave turkey is probably the better one. Both are good.
In fact, I'm going to read you this one. Ouch mouse. What's an ouch mouse?
Oh, that's got to be a porcupine, I reckon.
Well, hedgehog, but yeah, I think it works for hedgehog, porcupine as well. Nope rope.
Yeah, that's got to be a snake.
Yeah, that's a snake. And then she's put, I call my whippet my speed noodle.
Speed noodle.
Which kind of works. Danny Kevin has put, telling my dog not to eat the spicy sky raisin. Can you tell me what a spicy sky raisin is?
I know exactly what that is. That's got to be a bee or a wasp.
That's a bee. Zara's replied to that saying, jalapeno sky raisin, my dog loves them. Annie Italian Terry has put, majestic flap flap. Let me make this a bit more specific.
Is that a swan?
No, majestic sea flap flap.
Ah, that's got to be like a ray, a manta ray or something.
It's a ray. Phil Barber has put the devil's rice.
Ants. Specifically like fire ants or bullet ants.
No, dwarf white isopods.
Oh, fair enough.
Leia Louise Williams has put carpet sharks or cat snakes.
Carpet sharks or cat snakes. Carpet sharks or cat snakes. No, unless it's like, giant centipede, I don't really know.
Well, I mean, they got a fairly ferocious bite. It's a ferret.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Jen Babs has put, my whippet is also a snoozle hoot. I don't think that's what you're asking for, though. Giraffes are just rafts. Sparrows are spodgers. Long-tailed tits are pom-poms. Orcas are masters of the universe. And horses are money pits.
Money pit, yeah, I'm sure.
Your other half has put Bolita.
I don't know what that is, but I didn't know what that was, but I did read that comment, so I do know what it is, and I'll be cheating if I answered.
I mean, is that the Spanish name for wombat? Is it?
I genuinely don't know. Do you know what? I'm going to translate that now.
Yeah, please check that. That's interesting, though. Jen Babs has also put, sheep are grass maggots. To my dairy farming friends.
Wombat is wombat in Spanish.
Oh, okay. What's bolita then?
I don't know. Do you know what? I'm going to ask
honestly.
Come and explain.
Ellis Jackson has put, when our daughter was 3 years old, she came out of a cracker, came out with a cracker while we were at the beach. She pointed at a group of gulls and said, look, sea pigeons. I like that. She's now 5, and we still call them that as a bit of a joke. Phil Barber has put again, forbidden blueberries. Can you tell me what those are?
Like blue bottle flies?
No, it's blue death feigning beetles.
Oh, right. Okay.
Works quite nicely. Philip Schofield has put fish rat. What's a fish rat?
Fish rat.
I'd even go as far as saying tuxedo fish rat.
Oh, that's a penguin.
Yep.
I've heard that before somewhere.
Of which Zara Jackson has put, don't you mean tuxedo chicken? Which is the one that I've referred to them more often than not. He's then replied with, bitey little bastard tuxedo chicken.
Just to interrupt you briefly, we have our our Spanish
resident
our
Spanish speaker,
resident Spanish cupboard dweller here. We were wondering, but I just tried to translate wombat because of your comment, and it said that the Spanish for wombat is wombat. So we were wondering what bolito means.
Bolita.
But what was it? Bolita.
Bolita.
Yeah.
It's a little ball.
A little.
Oh, I like it.
Bola, ball, yeah. And then the bolita makes us more.
A little ball.
Ball. I like it.
What was my comment?
You said wombat.
Wombat is bolita.
Although I will say that a wombat is not exactly small. They're relatively
cute.
Big.
I
feel like they still fall into like cute size territory.
I suppose. I suppose.
They're ladies, aren't they?
Yeah, they can get a little bit bigger. It depends on the species.
They're like a fluffy little ball.
Yeah, they're cool. Thank you.
So, yeah. Our very own Drew has put overrated, murderous. Well, actually, I mean, there's quite a few of them.
I know where this is going.
What are the overrated, murderous expletives, do you think?
That's meerkats.
Yes, it is.
Overrated and murderous, and then is meerkat enough? But then following that up with something inflammatory is just... Seals the deal.
Seals the deal for him. And he's also put white cloudy plague.
I know this. This is the pigeon. He did the creature feature on it.
It's not a pigeon, no.
It was a bird though, wasn't it? Blocked out the sky.
No.
No?
No, oh, it is
on, tell me.
Cheap because they're a blight on our countryside.
Yeah, okay.
Drew not letting up at all there, so...
Makes sense.
And the final one, this is one of my favourites, and I love this name for them, from my brother, bin chicken. What's a bin chicken?
That's the ibis, isn't it? That goes
that
in
is.
The bins in Oz.
Yep, although you can still call the ibises we get in this country bin chickens. I'm sure they just haven't figured out how to get to the bins yet. So anyway, some really good ones there. Some really, really fun ones. After quite a few weeks of us completely forgetting to put this question up, this week's question is because going back as far as the Archaeopteryx episode, actually, us forgetting to put this one up because we came up with other questions at the time. What, in your opinion, is the single most important fossil find ever made? So, Aaron, I mean, I think we know what you've said. It's Archaeopteryx.
In my opinion, Archaeopteryx. There are plenty of others that are of almost equal importance, especially if you're looking at it from a human point of view. But for me personally, with the information it divulges about the relationships between the dinosaurs that we wish we could see today and the dinosaurs that we love seeing around us today, I just think that one's a wonderful, wonderful fossil. And it's exquisite.
Well, that's quite true. I think that's, yeah. And without going completely too much off the rails, I'm going to have to say, purely because it is possibly one of the funniest early finds of a dinosaur before we even had the word dinosaur, I'm going to say the most important find was the find of what is called scrotum humanum. Now, scrotum humanum is a fossilized end of, wait for it, a megalosaur femur.
Oh, right.
So imagine taking the end of a femur and slicing it off just at the very end. So you end up with, well, as the name suggests, you could probably guess what it looked a bit like. It was believed by the person who found that this particular thing that it was the somehow fossilized or petrified remains of a giant human scrotum from a giant, presumably like pre-Noah's flood,
Jesus.
Or that had died. Well, yeah, I believe that's something to do with the whole thing as well. But this particular fossil was actually a dinosaur fossil that had been found before we even knew dinosaurs existed. So it was found. It's apparently never been found since. It disappeared somewhere. But all of these original like manuscripts and early sort of journals of scientific curiosities from that particular time show this rather detailed drawing of what is now, or what was put down at the time as scrotum humanum. So I'm going to say that's one of the most interesting ones, because it's always a good one to talk about in a sort of random fact sort of setting.
That's correct me if I'm wrong, but Megalosaurus was the first carnivorous dinosaur ever found, yeah, wasn't it?
It was dinosaur number two.
And like I say, there's an argument for others. Is it Lucy?
The Australopithecus.
Yeah, that one. There are plenty of them out there, so I'm really hoping that
people get involved interesting on this one,
because there's loads of them out there, and I'd love to hear people's reasoning behind it.
Yeah. Well, as Aaron just said, dear listeners, if you want to let us know what you feel is the single most important fossil find, it doesn't have to be a dinosaur, doesn't have to be a human, it doesn't have to be anything along those lines. You know, it could be scrotum humanum, it could just be because it makes you laugh. You can get in contact with us about that on our Facebook page, where that goes up every week. You can also find us on our emails as well, thenathistorycupboard@gmail.com, where you can get in contact with us. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm definitely still calling it Twitter, as well as Instagram. More importantly, you can also find us on our fantastic T-Mill store, where Drew has been tinkering and been making all sorts of new versions of the bits and pieces of merch that you can pick up there. So go and check that out. You can also support us in other ways, like our fantastic Patreons, who have done exactly that, helped us out on Patreon. Aaron is now going to name our Patreons in what voice this week?
Okay, so this week, yes, I'll do a voice. Now, if you remember, this week is actually the week where I was going to rap the names to you guys, but guess what?
Oh, yeah, we didn't make it.
No, we didn't make it. Wah, wah.
No one wanted to hear the rap.
So I tell you what, if we hit, here's a threat, if we don't hit 10 Patreon by the time we get to Gareth's birthday, then I will rap. So if you don't want to hear the rap, you've got to get your friends to sign up to Patreon.
Fair
anyway,
enough.
Anyway, this week I'm gonna do it in Megatron's voice. Now, this won't be Megatron from the cartoons, because I've never tried to do that one, but I will try and do Megatron from the movies. So here we go. We'd like to say thank you to
Chelsea McKee, Honeybee, Jen Greenhall, Fogtober, and definitely not Prime.
There you go. There's not just a list of our Patreons, but also a threat there to acquire more. I don't know if that will work, but why not? So, yeah, you can join our fantastic Patreons by going to our Patreon page and having a look at what we do there. You can also, as well, support us in a variety of other ways. The first and easiest way of all of those is, of course, to listen to the podcast. If you've made it this far, thank you very much. You're doing more than you know. You can like, share, and subscribe on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. Tell a friend, tell an enemy, tell a binturong, and smell its poo? Yeah, why not? Going to find out one way or another. And that helps get the word across that we exist, that we're here, and talking about what kind of poo we like the smell of, whilst Aaron does a Megatron voice into a bottle. But that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode. So a big thank you, Aaron, for coming along.
Is it fear or courage that compels you, listeners?
I think it's probably a bit of both, actually. But
no, thank you for having me, Gareth. And thank you, everybody, for coming along this wild ride.
And a big thank you to you at home. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye.
One's poo does not simply smell of popcorn.